And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM. And we're speaking with Fearcra O'Loughlin, second mate on the Challenger 1, part of the flotilla that was sent with humanitarian aid to be delivered to Gaza. That's been all over the news. Let's see if we have him on the line. Fearcra, can you hear me?
Indeed I can, Brendan. Thank you.
And I'm very pleased that I can hear you as well. You're coming in very clearly. So it was great to get a hold of you so quickly by email. I know there's a lot going on and a lot of interviews, a lot of international reporters and interviews flying back and forth. And you've just recently returned to Ireland and you've been through quite a lot and you've seen quite a lot of things. So it's correct to say you were the second mate aboard the Challenger 1 in this flotilla. So essentially, this was one of the number of ships that was featured all over international media. And your ship was assigned to deliver aid. Can you tell us a little bit about the cargo on that ship?
Well, I can tell you about the ship. Yeah, the Challenger 1 was actually a passenger ship. We were there to provide support for the cargo ships and for the Marmara, because we had this idea of bringing high-profile people, including parliamentarians, also people who were used to be high up in the United Nations and actually high up in the Pentagon and former colonels and diplomats in the U.S. and to make sure that if we were attacked, that people would know that, you know, we were well able to represent and protect ourselves internationally, and that was our purpose, really. So we were right beside the Marmara when it was attacked. Ours was a U.S. registered vessel because we thought that perhaps the Israeli Navy would be less likely to attack a U.S. vessel, which was not the case.
No, absolutely not. You certainly got perhaps a more than a lot of people bargained for. You had a number of prominent civilians aboard your vessel, as well as material aid. And I understand that it was difficult even from the get-go, because your ship, along with the Challenger 2, experienced a mechanical failure. I believe there was a failure with the steering. Did you personally experience that?
Every step of the way there was a problem. The Israeli spokesperson on European affairs actually talked to the European ministers ahead of our trip and asked them not to let us attend the flotilla, which is a bit rich, because as valid passport holders, we have every right to participate in this legal mission. And it just goes to show you, because in the past they've abused our our passports and used them in their assassination. So that was one stage. When I was actually flying there, it's kind of interesting, through Berlin, my flight was suddenly refunded and I was stranded in Berlin. And if it wasn't for the help of a friend, I wouldn't have got to Crete. And then leaving Crete again, both the Challenger 1 and the Challenger 2, which had been completely surveyed, both started letting in water. And the Challenging, and both had problems with steering. The Challenger 2 had a bigger problem with steering than we did. But, you know, it has to be checked, and we can't be sure, but there were a lot of strange circumstances. And once again, as we entered Cypriot waters, we talked to a police helicopter that got sent out and told us that despite the fact that we were carrying European parliamentarians and Cyprus is an EU state, they had been ordered to keep us as far away as possible from their waters. We told them that we were carrying parliamentarians and that we may have some technical difficulties, and could we then come into port? And they said that despite the fact that we were taking on water, we would need special permission, as they said, and were most unhelpful. So Cyprus has really shown itself to have been subject to enormous pressure from Israel, because there's no reason why an EU state would ban an EU skippered vessel with EU parliamentarians that was in danger of perhaps sinking. So this was before the attack, but we then had to choose to go to the nearest port, which was not in Greek Cyprus. So we had to go to Famagusta in Turkish-occupied northern Cyprus, and we entered Famagusta. We were told that could not leave the boat. So even though Turkey was later very helpful once we were murdered, at the time, you know, as maybe as a NATO member, Turkey was also under pressure not to help us at the time, and we were not too sure what was going to happen at all. So we spent about 24 hours in Famagusta in northern Turkish Cyprus, and eventually decided that we would take the ship. And the original plan was to take the passengers to the Mavi Marmara to then put all of us on the Mavi Marmara, and then the Challenger 1 would return to Cyprus and go in for repairs. It was only by myself and the first mate and some other people managed to convince the captain to change his plans and take the boat to Gaza. And had this not happened, it is well possible that myself and the other passengers would have been on board the Mavi Marmara when it was murderously assaulted.
I'm just thinking it was certainly difficult enough for you to get there with the Challenger 1. In terms of the steering issue, do you remember what that was like? Were you able to tell that there had been a steering issue?
Yeah, I was steering the boat different stages, yeah. It on ours, it wasn't that bad, but it wasn't perfect. And, you know, these the Challenger 1, the steering went completely. They could only steer it with their engines. Ours was going, and you could really feel it. We decided that we could continue, but it was very strange.
Yes,
but
yes.
That was...
Oh, sorry, I mean, it's just, as you said, there are many roadblocks to get on the way, and then when you were finally on the verge of arriving, of course, that was when the big attack came. And, of course, you were not aboard the Mavi Marmara, you were not aboard the major Turkish vessel, but all of the ships were boarded. Some people aboard Challenger 1 witnessed the boarding, and the rest of you certainly experienced it. So what was your experience of the boarding itself?
Well, yeah, it's important that you bring up that point, because I've heard the spin doctors from Israel... and their cohorts in BBC and CNN and Fox and other places somehow say that the Mavi Marmara was the only one that was attacked, that the rest of us somehow cooperated, which is not true. One Dutch journalist got shot in the nose with a plastic bullet on our vessel. They took our ship with violence and threatened to use all military force necessary to stop us, and at one stage attempted to ram us. That was when the captain decided not to proceed, because when we saw the Mavi Marmara being attacked and we saw the gunfire coming from helicopters, and it was really just horrific, the captain made the decision to put the throttle down and use all of our 1,296 brake horsepower and get out of there and try and get to Gaza. They pursued us for about 20 minutes and they couldn't catch us because of our wake. They couldn't board us. They could have caught us, but they couldn't have boarded us. And then we saw port side another vessel coming at high speed towards us. The captain himself had been attacked in a previous mission, and his ship had been rammed. So he took the decision, as we didn't have a steel hull boat or anything, we had a wooden hull, that the best thing to do was just to cut the engines, and at which stage the commandos boarded our ship violently, and as I said, one journalist, Kate Geraghty of the Sydney Morning Herald, who used to work for the Irish Times, she was tasered as they were boarding. She was an independent journalist, she was not an activist, but she was tasered. Then another journalist, a Belgian woman, got shot right in the nose, and it swole up to a very large size. These plastic so-called paintball bullets, but they're not like the sort of paintball bullets that you go out playing with at the weekend. They were much more hardcore. And they took one Arab-Israeli member of our crew, not crew, she was a passenger, and they hooded her. They tied her up, took her onto one of their boats first and took her back onto our boats, hooded her, and pressed themselves up against her in a way that she felt that she was being sexually assaulted, as well as being violently attacked and held in stress positions. Other members were trampled into the broken glass. They smashed the glass to get in to the cabin where a 63-year-old retired U.S. Colonel Anne Wright was sitting, and others. We had an 80-year-old man from Washington State. He was there too, and they used most appalling violence against us too. None of us were killed, thankfully, but it was all very close.
Yes.
So yeah, there. I don't know if you want me to go into further details of the attack on our vessel, or if you'd like an eyewitness account of the attack on the Mavi Marmara. Or
did you see both? I'm just thinking here. I saw Anne Rice, the Colonel Anne Rice, as you mentioned. She just released a video yesterday about the violence of the attack itself. You personally witnessed that as well. Were you able to see the other ship?
Absolutely. I was lying on the bow of my ship, of our ship, when the Mavi Marmara was attacked. I was recording it. I had a camcorder. Unfortunately, they managed to get the tape away from me in Ashdod, but I was wearing the wrong type of underwear. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get it out of there. But we saw them first approach in the Zodiac, and they opened fire, and the helicopter then came. And as soon as the helicopter came, they were opened fire and were shooting live ammunition. So those videos that they keep on playing, that they've released, of these poor commandos, as if they're dropping in for a picnic and they're being attacked by these terrible Turks, that is just a fabrication and a very select editing. They were open fire. There were people shot through their heads from a vertical angle, and we could see this commence. There was no orchestrated sort of or planned resistance. People found anything rubbished and they started throwing it down on the boats, and they used a 4 to 5 bar pressure hose to try and stop them boarding. And they were attacked murderously in response. And just to clarify, you'll see it soon when the autopsy reports come out, but the American who was killed, he was shot in the chest, then 4 times in the face. Now, I don't know how you can spin that as self-defense, but that was murder. That was absolutely premeditated murder. We believe that there was actually a hit list, because the man who was in charge of the internet cafe on the Mavi Marmara was shot at his desk through the eyes. There were other people shot through the eyes. This was, and this will come out, and this we have to be very sure that this was a murderous attack on the Mavi Marmara, because I think they operationally thought it is the biggest challenge in the flotilla, and that, you know, okay, we'll kill a few Turks, we'll kill a few Muslims, and then we'll blame the Muslims, and that'll be our way of doing it. And that's what we see them trying to do now, you know, as if, and then trying to cajole the Europeans and North Americans by saying, oh, well, you guys weren't so bad, but, you know, you didn't know who was in your midst. These guys were serious and dangerous, which is completely untrue. Those people who were killed were, were journalists, were photographers. And it's just appalling.
It seems there's an effort to create doubt and uncertainty about people on the boat. And, I mean, as horrific as the situation was on the Turkish vessel, it wasn't easy for you either, being boarded and attacked like that. I imagine you, like all the hundreds of other people, I think some 600 in total, were taken into custody. Can you tell us about that?
700, yeah. What? So 650, yes.
Where were you taken?
We were taken to Ashdod. Speaking with Anne Wright, I will just tell you my one experience of severe violence when I was threatened was when we arrived into Ashdod. We all linked our arms and said, well, you promised us to speak to our embassy officials once we go to Ashdod. Because they actually told us, you know, we're just going to bring you to Ashdod and we're going to release you and you can, like, walk to Gaza if you want. We're just going to take your vessel. The commanders were lying through their teeth just to get us to cooperate. So when we got to Ashdod, we said, okay, we're not moving. We want to see our embassy officials. And then they went for the more vulnerable members of our party. They went for 80-year-old David Schimmerhorn, and then they went for Anne Wright, former U.S. colonel and deputy ambassador in Afghanistan and other places, and they went to physically grab them and pull them up because we were all linking arms, at which point we all protested. I raised my voice and I said, do not dare touch her. You do not know who she is, and there will be repercussions for your actions. At this, one of the commandos, who I hadn't seen earlier, I don't know, did he come on from the port and wanted a bit of the action, pulled out his taser, put it to my head, and told me to shut up. This was extremely traumatic, of course, but I took the decision that, as a crew member, the best thing I could do would be to say to the other commandos that he must leave, he must sheathe his weapon, leave the boat, and then I will leave of my own free will. Which happened, and that's what I did. And then when I got on to the port, there were a lot of Israeli-chosen journalists there, and I said, they are threatening to taser us, they are being violent against pensioners, and, we want to speak to our embassy officials right now. I repeated this, and it was another day and a half before I saw anyone from the Irish embassy. But yeah, I can talk to you about the detention as well and the conditions.
Yes, I'm getting the impression, as you said, that there was an effort to divide and conquer among the activists as well as in terms of public opinion. So can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, you have to. It was very interesting in a way, because we were brought to Beersheba prison, which is an apartheid prison. You have the Palestinian showers and you've got the Jewish Israeli showers. The Palestinian showers have CCTV at every angle. There's no privacy. And the Israeli Jewish showers are a lot more private, which is just, you know, it's just a detail, really. It's just an aside. But this is the mentality of the people, your captors, of our captors. And I would also like to say that, you know, when we are talking, it's, you know, when we're generalizing and talking about the Israelis, of course, we should be fully aware there are many Israelis who are completely aghast at what happened. But also, there's a dichotomy in this. There is a slick, well-oiled PR and politically savvy machine that is Medinat Israel, the state of Israel, and the people like Mark Regev, who can justify anything. And then there are the poor, unfortunate, indoctrinated youngsters who carry out the orders and believe that they're doing a great service for their nation and their people. And they are the brutes, and they are the people who are not that sophisticated. And that's why it was so dangerous. That, you know, we're dealing with the slick stuff now, but in there, these people are trained to kill people on a daily basis. And, you know, we could see them sort of bragging about it and joking about it, but it's an inherently racist state. And that we could see that when we got into prison, the first time we were in common area, they said, okay, all the Turkish people over here and all the Europeans and Americans, just stay where you are. And we said, hang on a second, no. I said, we all came together, we are a party together, and no one's getting divided, we're staying together. And they said, okay, well, all the Muslims over on the left and all the Christians. I said, what are you talking about? We're all in this together. There are Muslims, Jews, and Christians, and whatever you want here. There was the son of a Holocaust survivor in our party who was arrested. There was also an Israeli who had been a commando in the past who was put in solitary confinement for being a supposed traitor. And we said, no, we're not going to be divided. And we then formed a committee. The committee members were comprised of translators who could speak to their members of their nationality, and then we could come to a consensus. And we said to the governor of the prison, Shalom, what's his name, we said, okay, so you can talk to the committee. We will then confer with each other and the rest of the people. We will come back to you with an answer. So you can put requests to us, and we are your captives, we will put demands to you. Now, we demand to speak to our embassies. We demand a phone call. We demand proper food, more water. We demand, etc., etc. And it was quite incredible, because we actually, to a certain extent, took control of our own destiny in that prison. At the beginning, they were very violent, and towards the end, we were telling them what to do, really. And at different stages, Mossad agents came in. They weren't wearing uniforms. They had just this green paper band, like a concert sort of wristband on their wrists. And we could see them sort of moving freely among the other uniformed people. And we identified them later to be Mossad, because a couple of us were interrogated by them. But they were trying to pick out individuals and, you know, question them, and extremely dangerous, you know, because once they find out any old detail, they'll try and pin something on people and, you know, make up stuff. And they were aiming for the Muslim-looking guys with beards, you know, essentially, but also anyone who showed leadership skills and people who were organizing, they were picking those people out. Towards the end, they came to me at one stage, and this guy said, gave me this foul look, and he said, you come here. And I just turned around and said, no, you, sit down. And he said, hey, what? And I said, sit down. He goes, I just want to talk. And I go, well, talk here. And he actually sat down with me, and with some other of my fellow prisoners, we said, explain yourself, what are you doing here? Are you Mossad? And he wouldn't answer. So one of the Muslims said, are you Mossad? We shouldn't be talking to you. Are you Mossad? And he wouldn't answer. And I said, would it be fair to say that we can ask you that question, but because of your professionalism, you cannot answer, and he nodded. So we could deduce that he was an Assad agent. He talked about his grandparents, and we said, and his family, and his previous work experience. And he called himself Adil, but then he said, AKA Adil. And I said, you know, how can you justify what you're doing to us? And how can you justify what's happened? And how can you continue to be aggressive towards us when you've murdered people in international waters? It's like, this is a war crime, and you're are party to it, and, you know, in a court you could be held accountable for your actions. And he was trying to be nice and stuff. He was like, oh, you know, I didn't vote for Benjamin Netanyahu. And I said, well, we don't really care, but you are carrying out orders. And he actually talked a bit to us, and then expected us to return, and we just, once we got the information from him, we dismissed him. So it was quite interesting. We did really reverse the roles, and it was quite empowering, quite a good experience.
Quite extraordinary. You took control of the situation, but so importantly, you remained in solidarity with the other prisoners. And so
absolutely,
I understand.
You know.
They had been saying, you know, what was it, all the Turks come here or all the Muslims come here, but you said no.
Yeah, absolutely. We did not let that happen. Because, you know, you've seen it now. They're Western sensibilities. They're trying to appeal to Western sensibilities and go, hey, you guys are nice. You know, you like fluffy bunnies and peace and stuff and chocolate, and that's nice. But, like, you're in with these hairy Muslim guys that speak weird, and they were really serious. And, you know, they're trying to create doubt, which is not true. And, you know, I've been on other radio stations, and a lady said to me, oh, you know, I support what you're doing, but, like, why did you go with so many Muslims? Why did you go with Islamic people? That really shows that you weren't about human rights. I'm like, excuse me. There is inherent racism in our part of the world. And I said to the woman, I said, you know what you've just said? It's like, you've said that Muslims can't be human rights activists. You've said that Islamic people can't be human rights activists. I said, you are exposing your own racism. And, you know, it's be careful, you know, but that's what Israel is trying to tap into at the moment. And it's very important that we remain firm. The Turkish boat was a completely unarmed, peaceful boat, and they were attacked most violently, and some of them used physical force in forms of using their hands and things like that, anything they find to throw at them, which if I would say to anybody, if you ever come and attack me in my boat with a machine gun, I will gladly try and push you back and etc. But they did actually achieve disarming three of the commandos. There was a former US Marine on board who is a great guy and who has renounced violence ever since he was part of Desert Storm. He was able to disarm them, got rid of the bullets, and, you know, sat the three of them together and actually gave them their weapons back once the bullets had been disposed of. And more or less said, you know, we're not going to kill you. We just want you to go back and go back to your ships. And they released them. And this was after they had killed five of the people on Mavi Marmara. So, you know, it was if there were really people who with murderous intent and violence on the Mavi Marmara, they could have had, you know, they could have killed three Israeli commandos easily. They could have. But they didn't, because they wanted to prove a point. And they wanted the soldiers to know, we don't want to hurt you on a personal level. And actually, we don't blame you on a personal level before we blame the governments and their orders that you are being asked and duped into carrying out. And actually, since then, it's interesting. Some of the commando officers have come out and said, why were we asked to be part of this mission when it, from an Israeli point of view, should have been a police mission? We are trained as commandos to, you know, an elite force to use violent and lethal, deadly force. Why were we brought in with these civilians? And there is a debate within, I believe, the Israeli military now, and I think this is very valid, and I think that's where real change can happen, as we saw in the United States during the Vietnam War, is when, you know, officers themselves and brass start questioning the policies of the government, because from an Israeli point of view, they should have waited till we got into Gaza's waters, and then there's a territorial kind of dispute, then they should have sent the police, and, you know, that would have been a much better PR exercise for them too. But, you know, it's the pig-headedness, it's that we've got guns, so we're going to use them, we're going to kill a few Muslims, and then we're going to blame the Muslims. And, you know, it's really this arrogance that we're witnessing. And,
yes,
you know, people were murdered. People, as I said, the guy in the internet cafe was shot through the eyes, and the American was shot four times in the face after he was shot in the chest. This was not self-defense on behalf of the commandos. This was something very, very sinister. And as I said, it's like watching a Bloody Sunday on the high seas. I witnessed a Bloody Sunday on the high seas. As an Irish person, it goes deep, you know.
Yes, absolutely. And I can imagine perhaps you're thinking of some of these things in the prison as well. Perhaps, as you said, perhaps there will be a growth in Israeli resistance to this militarism, and people who are following orders will start questioning them. And certainly this entire flotilla has brought enormous attention to the entire issue. So I know it's time to wrap things up, but I wanted to thank you so much for giving us this detailed and vivid account. You have been heroic in this. You're part of one of hundreds of heroes that were on this flotilla. And, you know, I wanted to thank you for getting this across to us, the information before we would get it from anywhere else, and providing us with these details and helping us create links to Ireland. I know that, yeah. I mean, the Rachel Corrie and other activists have been doing their part and raising awareness of Rachel Corrie as well. So this whole thing is ballooning, and it's thanks to people like you that the world is turning increasing attention and focus to the human rights issue that's happening in Gaza and Palestine, and you did everything you could to push forward and get that issue across. So thanks so much for being on our program. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, amazing. Brendan. And, you know, it's wonderful to talk to to you and to your listenership. And there is another issue with a passport that was stolen. And if you would like to call me back in the future, that's unfolding at the moment. So please stay in touch, and I'd be delighted to talk to you in the future. And thank you, Hamilton.
Again,
thank
you, Ontario. Well, thanks so much for getting. We'll be in contact with you. We've got people in Ireland that we've started speaking with, thanks to all of these efforts, including your own. So thanks very much, and we'll be in touch.
No problem, Brendan. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.